Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is with us as usual. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Jack.
How are you?
I'm fine.
This is a heinous crime that we're going to talk about this morning. Tell us about it and our guest, if you will.
Well, this is one of the nastiest crimes I ever heard about.
And you've seen some pretty nasty ones.
Yeah, and I remember reading about this when it occurred. In January of 1997, a guy named Robert Woodall abducted a very popular, very nice young 16-year-old girl from a local convenience store as she returned a rented movie, and this was in Muhlenberg County. Woodall took Sarah Hansen, 16-year-old Sarah Hansen, from the parking lot. She went to a wooded area. He raped her, beat her, used a box cutter to slash her throat. He then dragged and discarded her body into a local lake, and the autopsy revealed water in Sarah's lungs, which means that she drowned.
She was alive when he threw her in the lake.
He was sentenced to death in 1998, and that's when the appeal process began. And we all know about the appeal process in death penalty, death sentence cases. We had major news that this past week on this case, because the death penalty in sentence in this case was reversed by a federal judge, and then that reversal was affirmed by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. This case went to the United States Supreme Court, and our guest, Susan Lenz, was the superstar assistant attorney general who handled the appeal with a couple of other people, but she was the lead person. Susan has been an assistant attorney general for many years. She's a member of the attorney general's death penalty branch, and she's our guest today. Susan, welcome.
Well, good morning, Ray. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
Susan, as working in the death penalty branch, now you've got a couple of responsibilities over there, but you're in the appellate section, and you know, Jack, I spent some years in the Attorney General's office in the appellate section.
Didn't know that.
So I got an idea how it works, but I never went to the Supreme Court and argued a case as Susan did. But when you get a case like this that's, you know, is gonna be appealed, how do you begin the process of dealing with it?
Well, when you first get the case, it arrives on direct appeal. And, of course, the first thing that you do is you go through the record. And in these death penalty cases, the records are immense. I think on direct appeal, Robert Keith Woodall raised about 30 issues. So you become very familiar with the record and the legal issues, and you you have to be very organized. And, of course, you research the issues and brief them in the Kentucky Supreme Court. That's what happens in death penalty cases.
This is a silly question, but I don't know the answer. Well, who raises the issues? Is it him? Is it his attorney?
Well, it's in death penalty cases, the defendants are always represented by counsel, and a lot of times it's appointed counsel, usually more than one, and counsel for the defendant raise the issues.
I see. Okay.
Well, now, I want to make something clear.
Okay.
Susan is a very nice lady and has been doing this for some time. I'm not a nice lady or a nice guy.
Yeah.
And any comments I make about the death penalty appeal process are not don't attribute them to her.
Yeah.
Because I'll say what's on my mind, and Susan is far more diplomatic than me. So, Susan, is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay. Now, tell me what you learned about the crime itself, because I know we've had a number of victims, survivors of homicide victims on this show. And most of the time, this is interesting, Jack. In America, people give folks who have lost loved ones 30 days. After 30 days, they typically don't want to hear about it anymore. And people that have lost loved ones, like Sarah Hansen, want to talk about it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they realize that people just kind of shut them down or avoid them or that sort of thing if they think they're going to talk about it. And one of the things we try to do here is have a victims first program. Now, have you had an opportunity to learn about Sarah Hansen and her family, Susan?
I have, Ray. Her family is absolutely lovely. They're some of the nicest people that I've ever met, and Sarah herself was, by all accounts, an outstanding high school student and a lovely young lady. She was an honor student, a member of both the National Honor Society and the Beta Club. She was a cheerleader, a medalist in swimming and diving, and as I understand it, she was an incredible trumpet player, and that's just to name a few things about Sarah.
I noticed the picture we have of her, she looks like she's in a band uniform holding a trumpet. She must have been in the band.
She was.
Yeah.
She was a darling girl, a little blonde-headed, blue-eyed little girl.
Okay, so what happens then is the case was dealt with, and it was in Muhlenberg County, and Ralph Vick was the Commonwealth attorney that handled the prosecution of the case. And I talked to Ralph, and he suggested that Susan would be the best person to talk about this because, you know, Jack, going to the Supreme Court and making an argument before the Supreme Court is unusual, and it's impressive. People that have been there and argued a case are kind of, people like me kind of are in awe of them because I couldn't say poo-poo if I had a mouthful in front of the Supreme Court.
It's a big deal.
Yes, yeah. It is.
Yeah.
Okay, so Susan, tell us a little bit about when you the conviction was reversed by a federal judge. Who was that judge?
It was Judge Boyce Martin, who's now retired.
Yeah. And he's, matter of fact, from Kentucky.
So he was sentenced to die, and this federal judge reversed that decision. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
What was it based on? What was the reversal based
on? Susan will know all about that.
Yeah.
Well, it was based on a jury instruction issue that he raised. And what happened was, after Woodall committed this crime, the evidence of his guilt was overwhelming. Sarah's blood was found on his front door. Her blood was on muddy and wet clothing found underneath his bed. His DNA was on her vaginal swabs. His fingerprints were on the van she had been in. So amidst all of that evidence, Woodall pled guilty. And he pled guilty to every crime he was charged with, which was capital murder, capital kidnapping, and first-degree rape. In Kentucky, in order to get the death penalty, you have to have certain aggravating circumstances. In this case, it was rape committed in the course of a murder and in the course of a kidnapping. So Woodall admitted to every single thing that made him eligible for the death penalty. And in Kentucky, trials are divided into two parts. There's the guilt phase and then the penalty phase. So in Woodall's situation, because he had pled guilty, there was no need for a guilt phase trial, so they just had a penalty phase trial because the prosecutor was asking for the death penalty, and Woodall didn't agree to that. So,
could he have agreed to the death penalty?
He could have.
And that has happened before, hasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I know up in Linda Talley Smith up in Northern Kentucky has had that happen in a case. But so you don't put on all your evidence in the guilt phase, but you still have to put the evidence on in the penalty phase in order for the jury to understand exactly what occurred, don't you?
That's exactly right. And Ralph V Vic did a tremendous job because there was so much evidence, and he was able to marshal all that and put all that in front of the jury so that they could assess a proper penalty. And Woodall, who called a number of witnesses, did not testify himself, and so his attorneys asked the trial judge, who was Judge Bill Cunningham, who now sits on the Kentucky Supreme Court, he's now Justice Bill Cunningham, they asked Judge Cunningham to instruct the jury that they could not infer anything negative because of the fact that Woodall didn't testify. And Judge Cunningham said, that's not intellectually honest. He's pled guilty to everything. He no longer has a Fifth Amendment privilege. I'm not going to give that instruction because there's no case law that says that the jury can't consider lack of remorse or a number of other things, even though the defendant has pled guilty. And so that went to the Kentucky Supreme Court. They affirmed it until, as you said earlier, we got to the Sixth Circuit. Judge Martin said that violated his Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate himself. And so with that, I asked the United States Supreme Court to review it. And you're right, as you said earlier, it's incredibly difficult to get review. The Supreme Court gets about 8,000 requests each term, and they grant review in about 80 cases, so it's a little bit less than 1%. So it was terrific that we got review, and certainly the case deserved review.
This one went to the Supreme Court, and our guest this morning, Susan Lenz, is an assistant attorney general who actually did the presentation before the Supreme Court. I'm just curious, before we go on with this, and this is a real short segment before we have to break again, Susan, do they give you a specific amount of time?
For the argument
Yeah.
before the Supreme Court, yes. Each side has 30 minutes.
Gee! That's pretty quick, isn't it?
Well, yes, it actually did go by very quickly. It sounded like a long time before I did the argument, but afterwards I found that it moved very quickly.
Get into that after Jack takes the break at the bottom of the hour. But so all of a sudden you petitioned. Tell us a little bit about the death penalty branch there at the Attorney General's office.
Well, it's headed up by a fellow named Robert Long, and Robert does a great job explaining everything and leading the death penalty team. And there are a number of attorneys on it. I'm not sure exactly how many attorneys we have on the death penalty team right now. It might be about 8, I think. And they do a lot of good work. It's a hard and, you know, long, frustrating job because some of these cases take years and years and years to, bring to fruition.
That's the number one complaint that we hear on this program is, why does it take so dadgum long? Why does it?
Well, I think it seems to me the defense bar doesn't necessarily follow the rules. I mean, for instance, on collateral attack, they get one bite of the apple, and they repeatedly file amendments, they fight and look for every legal technicality they can, and of course that's their job. But it just takes a tremendous amount of time, and of course sometimes the courts take a long time to decide. I have a case now, I think, that is the oldest case on death row. The murders were committed in 1979, and we had a number of special judges sit on the case, and they would retire and another judge would take over, and they're just tremendous cases in terms of the length and the amount of paper in the case. It just takes a lot to get up to speed on them and to be able to make the ruling.
Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson with us, Assistant Attorney General Susan Lenz on the phone, and George has been on hold here for a while. George, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Morning. Thank you for listening to
Sure.
my call. I have a comment to make. I don't believe in death penalty, but this is one of those cases I struggle with because I think this guy deserves it. And I pray for her family, and this is one that puzzles me and why someone would be so evil to do this thing.
Well, George, I just read the most interesting article by a young man whose father was brutally murdered in Texas, and he witnessed the execution of this guy, And there are a couple of things he wrote in this article that I think are important. He says, this whole experience has made me think a lot about capital punishment, the death penalty. I would encourage people to think about the death penalty on a case-by-case basis, not in terms of being for it or against it. He says there are many circumstances where it's appropriate. When there's a murder, he says a person should ask, was this crime particularly brutal, above and beyond most murders? Was the evidence undeniable? And most importantly, does the person continue to be a threat? That's a pretty good description of how you should think about it. And most of the time, when people are aware of the circumstances about the death penalty, about a vicious murder for which there's an aggravating circumstance, they'll have to rethink sometimes. Thanks for the call.
Thanks for calling. I appreciate that. Now, how about these people, and then I'll let you get back with your interview, but how about these people who say, well, I think life in prison without the possibility of parole is really a harsher sentence than more or less putting them out of their misery. What do you say to those people?
Well, that's what a lot of them say, and that's what a lot of the guys on death row say. Once they have a death penalty, they fight like crazy to avoid the death sentence.
So it must not be a...
Well, it's just bogus. That's it. Susan?
Yes.
Okay, so all of a sudden you get this you get this reversal by Boyce Martin on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then what happens in the death penalty branch over there when you have to make a decision about where are we going with this?
Well, you discussed that. Robert and I had discussed the case, been discussing the case for many years, and so, we thought from the beginning, if the case were to get reversed in the Sixth Circuit, that we would ask for review. Although the merits of the issue itself were a close call, on federal habeas review, the judges are required by the law to give a lot of deference to the state court's decision. They have enormous power to overturn state court's decisions, and there have been some laws enacted that keep them from doing that. And so, based on the federal law, we felt like the federal court had overstepped its bounds in overturning the state court's decision, and obviously, the Supreme Court agreed with us,
and that was the basis of the request for to grant a writ of certiorari. Now, what does all that mean?
Well, a writ of certiorari is basically just asking the Supreme Court to review the case and see if the Sixth Circuit overstepped its bounds or not on habeas review, and there are a lot of rules that you have to follow in filing the cert petition. Cert petitions are very difficult to get. For instance, usually one of the most common reasons to get it is there is a division of rulings between the lower circuit courts. And in this case, we didn't really have that. We just had the Sixth Circuit not following the federal law. And I think that's really the reason that the U.S. Supreme Court granted it in this case. The Sixth Circuit has had quite a record recently of getting overturned in the United States Supreme Court for not following the habeas law.
Well, there you go. And that's, now I want to say something. I have received, I'm a past president of the National District Attorneys Association, and prosecutors around this country have been following this case. And Susan, I want to tell you, I can't tell you the number of prosecutors around the United States who have emailed me or called me or texted me about how pleased they are with you and the Kentucky Attorney General's office for taking this one to the hoop and winning. So compliments to you and Robert and the rest of you guys over there. Now, I want to talk a little bit about your preparation. So all of a sudden, your cert is granted, and you all of a sudden are going to go to the Supreme Court. After you throw up, then what do you do?
Well, after that, the first thing really that I did was I started to garner what's called amicus support, and amicus briefs are referred to as friends of the court briefs, and basically they are briefs written by other parties, not on the exact issue that your review is granted on, but on tangential issues that might be important to the case. And so that was the first thing that I did. And in fact, one of our amicus supporters was a fellow named Kent Scheidegger, who is, I think, a pretty well-known habeas expert in his field. He writes an excellent blog called Crime and Consequences. And anyway, Kent Scheidegger wrote one of our amicus briefs, and in that brief, he suggested that the U.S. Supreme Court put an end to a practice that was occurring a lot in federal courts, and especially in the Sixth Circuit, where the courts were adding together U.S. Supreme Court precedents and then extending them to a new area of law where the United States Supreme Court had never extended them. And habeas law prevents that from happening. Under habeas law, a state court decision can only be overturned, at least in this case, if it's contrary to or an unreasonable application of clearly established U.S. Supreme Court precedent. So that was a huge issue in our case. And while that wasn't really what we focused on at oral argument we were focusing on how far the Fifth Amendment should extend and whether there was clearly established law on whether this jury instruction was required. But when we got the opinion back this week, we thought one of the big things about the opinion was Justice Scalia, who wrote the opinion, said he sort of hammered shut this door that federal judges have been using to kind of circumvent the habeas law by adding precedents together and just extending them to a new area that they've never been extended to before. And so the Supreme Court said these federal judges have to stop doing that. They have to follow the habeas law and stop reversing these state court judgments and letting these convicted defendants go.
I'm telling you, now that's a lot of legal stuff that I like.
Yeah, my head's spinning.
Yeah, that I like hearing about. And probably most of our listeners are sitting around thinking, what does all that mean? Well, fact of the matter is that you get a conviction and you take the conviction on the facts up to the Supreme Court. Then you come back once that they say is a good conviction. Then the defense attorneys come back and they say, well, maybe that's right, but there are other issues that are important, and that's habeas kind of stuff, and that's where these defense lawyers just beat it to death, and they've been having some luck with these the federal appellate judges, and thank goodness somebody slammed the door on them finally.
Well, this is a fascinating case, and in some ways, I guess, Ray, we may have gotten a little technical this morning because we've had to, but it really is fascinating. And Susan, you said that Scalia wrote the opinion. Do you know why he specifically did, or do you know how those decisions are made as to which justice does what?
No, I really don't. I really don't know why he ended up writing the opinion. I was thrilled that he did write the opinion, though. He clearly understood the issue, and he did a marvelous job, and he's a terrific writer.
Okay, so all of a sudden, you've gotten your amicus support. You've done all of your research. Tell me, do you practice? What do? When you get ready to do this?
Well, when you're getting ready for oral argument, by then you've written, I had to write the opening brief since I was the petitioner, and then opposing counsel wrote a brief, I wrote a reply brief. So by the time you get ready to prepare for oral argument, you know the issues very well, but you have to be able to anticipate any questions that the justices may ask you. You know, we had each cited hundreds of cases in our brief, and so I literally went line by line through every brief trying to think of questions that I might be asked at oral argument. And in addition to that, I went to went through a series of what we call moot courts, and they're basically fake court sessions where practitioners who, for instance, I went to Washington, D.C., and I had a group of very experienced Supreme Court practitioners, and they pretend to be the justices. I stand at a podium, and they fire questions at me. And so that helps you formulate answers for the judge's questions for oral argument. And then basically that's what you do. Once the argument starts, I think typically the average is they let you speak for about 30 to 45 seconds before the questioning starts. So while I had a number of points prepared that I wanted to make to the court, I think I got four or five sentences out before Justice Kagan asked me the first question. And after that, the justices just continued to ask me questions for 30 minutes. And of course, you try to answer their questions as best you can.
Well, give me the setting. What time? How far in advance did you go up to Washington for this?
I went up about 10 days ahead of time, and just to give myself a chance to acclimate to the city and get comfortable. And as I said, I had two moot courts scheduled, and of course, I did a lot of studying and preparation. I worked, you know, night and day on it, and my co-counsel went with me, a fellow named Ian Sonigo, who I have tremendous respect for. He's an expert in federal habeas and in death penalty issues. And Ian and I both went, and, you know, he asked me questions for hours and hours on end every day, and we discussed all of the issues so that I could be prepared for anything once I got up there. Because when you're up there, you are alone. And as I read in one of my appellate practice books, you are alone and intellectually naked. I mean, you're just standing there, and you know,
it's all very
difficult questions.
It is what it is. Did you get a question asked that you didn't anticipate?
There was one question by Justice Kennedy that I hadn't really anticipated, but before I really had a chance to formulate an answer for that, Justice Kagan sort of interrupted the whole thing and asked me a question. So I ended up not really having to address it. But I would say all the other questions I had anticipated.
Now tell me the setting. Now, what time was your argument?
My argument was at 10 o'clock. Two arguments are heard on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, one at 9 o'clock and one at 10. So I was the second up, which was nice because I had the benefit of watching the counsel before me argue the case, and I had the opportunity to observe the court and see how active they were that morning and all of that, and sort of get a chance to relax a little bit. Although before your argument starts, there's a white light on the podium that goes off, signaling that the counsel who's arguing before you has 5 minutes left. So when I saw that white light go off, I was unnerved. I mean, you know, you can't help thinking, what if I stand up and nothing comes out of my mouth? But, of course, I stood up and started talking, and then once the questioning started, you just sort of forget where you are, and the courtroom is, you know, beautiful. It's very imposing, and it's such an honor and such a privilege to be there. And of course, you're talking to, you know, nine of the smartest people in the country, and they're very close to you. I would say, you know, maybe 10 or 15 feet away from you. Like I felt like they could see if I was writing something on my paper. That's how close you are.
So who gave you the most questions during the oral argument?
You know, I wouldn't say that I got an inordinate amount of questions from any of the justices. They all ask questions. I would say that Justice Breyer's questions are always the most difficult. His questions are very long, usually multiple parts. I think he asked me a three-part question, and they usually involve a hypothetical. So his questions maybe take the most time. I wouldn't say he asked me the most questions, though.
Did they all ask a question?
All except for Justice Thomas. And I think in his career, he's only asked a few questions, and he's sort of known for not asking questions. He believes that that's the time for the attorneys to talk to the court and you know, that the justices should let them talk. So he's the only one that didn't ask me a question.
Well, I'm gonna tell you, it was... You're a better man than I am. I'll tell you that. I would have just collapsed.
So after you're finished, you're just dismissed, I guess. Thank you, see ya, kind of thing?
Yes, and it's very quick. They want you out of the courtroom right away and really even sort of out of the building right away.
And then you have no clue as to when anything's going to happen, right?
No, you really don't. I think the average time this term has maybe been about 2.5 or 3 months for decisions, but, you know, we got this decision this week, but before that there were cases, my case was argued in December, but there were cases that were argued after my case that the decisions were already out. And so sometimes it depends on, you know, how controversial the decision is going to be. I didn't expect to have a unanimous decision. I thought that this case would be, on some level, in a way, could be a close call. And in terms of the habeas, I thought we should win, but you really just don't know what the court's going to do. So in our case, it was a 6-3 decision, so there were three people that disagreed with the majority opinion. There were three dissenters.
Do you know who they are? Are you told who they are?
Yes, you can see it when you read the opinion, and it was, you know, it was the more liberal justices, exactly who I thought it would be. It was Justice Breyer, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg.
Well, of course, we would have expected that, but...
that's right. The one I didn't expect, though, Justice Kagan is also very liberal, and she was actually on the majority side with Justice Scalia and the Chief Justice and the rest of them, but she asked really good open-ended questions. I think she was really trying to ferret out the issue and really try to figure it out.
Susan, thank you so much for being with us.
We sure are proud of you. Thanks for your hard work.